7.
Mr. Gibson, real 7. You were just saying you thought he was a doctor.
Yes, I think he was a trained medic of a sort, because at that point they started to do minor surgeries, like minor medication. If you went and you had dysentery, they gave you charcoal tablets. And of course, with suffering from dysentery myself, I went just like an early morning sick parade. You had to be escorted out through the camp by one of the guards, out through the main barrier across the road, and taken to the guard house, what was the Chinese quarters, a little bit further down the road. And you stood outside this hut, and the Chinese called you in. And there was a lot of women interpreters there as well, women Chinese, and they would stand no nonsense. You couldn't leer at them. They'd get all really uptight, and you'd get a good boot up the behind, you know. And they call you in, and I explained I had dysentery, and the Chinese in a white coat, wearing his military cap, starts writing out in symbols, and said, "You have got dysentery, yes. You must take this tablet," you see, and it was a charcoal tablet. Charcoal, black. And I said, "What? This was festering, this wound on my hand was festering, and it was forever being infected." And he says, what you get? I said, "Well, I think it's a piece of metal," trying to make him understand that there was a piece of metal in there. So he starts poking around and pulling all the bits apart. No anesthetics or anything like that. He'd done it there and then, and he forced it open with a pair of forceps, and he dug around inside, and he pulled it like a piece of thin tin out, and dusted it with powder, like a sulfur powder, and wrapped it up in a piece of very thin bandage. And he says, "Okay, now," he says. So I went off. Well, the hand got worse, because it was literally infected then. It was really going. It was already bad before, but it started to really give me a lot of pain. And just at that, prior to that, they'd already started getting the camp prepared for winter. They'd started foraging expeditions up into the mountains to cut wood, drag the wood back and chop it up in details, and stack it ready for the winter, for heating the houses. So every day, details of prisoners would go out. They'd be gone all day, and they'd have to carry so much cut logs back on their shoulders. Well, my shoulders had huge sores on them, because the bones were poking through, and trying to balance a pine log on. And they were quite big pine logs, pine trees, on my shoulders. Soon took the skin down to the bone, and huge sores appeared. Of course, your uniform was literally had fallen off, and you ended up used bits of old rag and raggy uniform, and used it as a pad on your shoulder to try and stop it. But that one morning I just couldn't go. There's no way that when they called for the detail, the form up to go off, I went, and then my hand was so painful, and the temperature was up, I knew, because I was sweating. I had a bad night, and I went to the interpreter, and I said, "I can't go because of this." And he says, "You must go." I said, "But I can't, because this is too painful, and it's superating." I said, "I feel bad. I just want to go and lie down in a corner somewhere." "You will go." I said, "I won't go." And after that, he shouted out. A guard came in and started giving me hell with his rifle butt. So after he worked me over for 5 or 10 minutes, I was just sort of huddled up trying to protect my head in the corner of the hut. They dragged me out, dragged me down the road through the barrier, and I got taken to the Chinese headquarters area and slung down into a pit. The pit was like a root storage place for probably the Koreans' village. It was covered with a mud hut, but it was like over the top of a huge pit. Well, the pit was about 7-8 feet deep, and I was just unceremoniously tossed into it, you see? So I lay at the bottom of this pit, and they slammed the door of the little hut that was over the top of it, and I stayed there for about 3 days. Nobody came near me. I had to do everything in the pit at one end and carry out all bodily functions at one end. I had dysentery bad. It wasn't very pleasant. And after about 3 days, the door opened again, and a Chinese interpreter, must have been a different one, one that I used to call Tojo. He looked like a Japanese with big glasses on. And he said, you have committed great crime to the Chinese people's volunteers, who have done nothing but kindness for you and looked after you. I couldn't see where, but that was their gist. You will confess your sins and you will be released back to your comrades. I said, oh, that's all right. 3 days in here, that was enough. I'd like to get out now, you know, I'd had enough. But the door shut. A whole day went by. I couldn't hardly tell whether it was day or night. It was pitch dark. Then the door opened, and I was dragged out of the pit by two guards. And just outside, I was sat at a little table, a rough little table, right? And this interpreter, Tojo, came along with a piece of paper, slapped it in front of me, and a pencil. He says, now, you confess your crime. Confess my crime. Now what? I had to think. What shall I take? So I said, right, I confess that I refuse to go on work detail. And instead of helping the camp by getting in the forage wood for the winter, I'd let the camp down. So I thought, would that do? So he came along, he read it. What this word? What this word? What this word? I read it to him. He said, no good, no good. Another piece of paper. You write your crime. Oh, ran again. Well, the crime I did, I refused to go on the orders of the interpreter. So I tried to, looking at the crime that they wanted, it's very difficult to get at first in the early days. Right, I disobeyed the orders of the interpreter, the officer, for which I'm extremely sorry. It will not happen again. I will go on work detail. I will do my share of the work needed for the camp survival in the winter. He come along again. No good, no good. He shouted something to the guards. They grabbed me, threw me back in the pit again. So I stayed in the pit a week. The only time the door opened was when the guard brought me a tin of rice and a drop of water. He just passed it down to me. And I stood up and just took it off him. And that went on for a week. And I'd been in there already about 3 or 4 days, so we were talking about nearly 10 days. The door opened again, I was pulled out again, sat down at the table again outside. Same interpreter, Tojo, come up. You will confess your crime. If you don't confess your crime, you will not join your comrades. You like it here? I said, no, I don't. You know. Then you will confess your crime. Puts a piece of paper down, pencil. Goes off, just leaves me there with a Tommy gun guarder. Well, what does he want? What crime? Then I thought, well, I clicked, yes, the old thing. I am an imperious lackey. The first words were, I am an imperious lackey. I have sinned against the Chinese people's volunteers who have only sought to help me and free me from the chains of capitalism. I have come to Korea to murder and rape and pillage the thing for which I confess, and I feel that I must purge myself. You know, usual. Again, it had to be all that political emphasis on it all the time. And he came back about an hour, I read it. Oh yes, back in the hole again. I thought, well, what have I done this time? I'm back in the hole. And he's taken off this piece of paper. Well, anyhow, about, must have been two days later, and by that time that hole was absolute cesspit. It was a cesspit. He came, or the guards came, pulled me out, told Joe turned up. It was morning. I could see it was morning, and it must have been October, November. Very cold. Got very cold in that hole at night. So it must have been coming up to the winter time. So it must have been around about November. I remember it was very cold, and we'd already, previous to my being incarcerated in the hole, been collecting this wood for winter stockpiles, as the Chinese called it, for our fires. And I thought, it's bitter cold. And he marched me out. I thought, another session at the table with another confession. But no, he marched me off up the road, me stumbling along like a scarecrow, stinking to high heaven. And it was parade time, and all the POWs were all out on the parade ground. They all had to stand up, and there was a box in front where the camp commandant stood, and the box where the interpreter stood. The interpreter who was there was interpreting the usual morning tirade from the camp commandant, who was like a political commissar type of thing. He was a commissar, actually, believe it, taken from the Russian, I think. That his whole thing was political. You must do this, you must do that, you must cleanse yourself from your previous life, and you must study hard, and you are students of the Chinese People's Volunteer. Then it was, we have one of your men who has been severely punished. He is going to read his confession to you. My big day. I thought, oh dear, I got to stand up in front of these hundreds of POWs and read out my crime. See? So anyhow, I got, I have to do it, because I wandered out of that hole. I didn't want to go back. I'd had enough. So I got up on the box and I read exactly from the letter, that the piece of paper that I'd signed. Apparently it had been passed as acceptable, and I had and the roars of laughter from the POWs, you know, you had to listen to it to believe it. They knew that it had been dragged out, and how it, because they knew where I was. There was others in the same plight, unbeknown to me, but they knew not a word of it was true. So it was just a big laugh, you know. That, I mean, as they were, they just laughed. And I made my, I apologized to the Chinese People's Volunteers, and to the North Korean people, to President Kim Il-sung and Chairman Mao, for this disgrace that I brought on myself and the working class. And I thought, well, just say it, because they're just laughing at anyhow. So it was good enough to get me out of the hole. Let the folks laugh. They enjoyed it. My mates were laughing. And you didn't get many things to laugh at. And seeing a scarecrow confess his sins, knowing it was a put-up job anyhow, gave them something to laugh at. Anyhow, I was released at that point back into society. The POWs society. And when I got back to the after roll call, and it all fell out and they all sort of drifted back, they started calling the work details. And I thought, oh, I'm on a work detail already, and I've just come out of this damn place, you know, I'm covered in excrement, and, you know. Well, when I realized, of course, that I was going to be on a work detail that morning, because it was the morning roll call, and I made hasty thing to the river, which ran at the back of the camp. Had a quick wash down to clean myself up. I hadn't had any meal that day because I'd been late coming from the what I should say was the headquarter area where I'd been kept, and of course I didn't have anything to eat that day or that morning. So we started off, it must have been about 10 o'clock in the morning, and headed off up into the hills. The details were to collect firewood for the coming winter. Everybody had to have a set weight. You had to have so many catties, as they called it, of I don't know how many pounds was in a Chinese catty, but they measured it in catties on a suspended scale. They held the scale up on a rope in a tripod and hooked your bundle of wood on and weighed it, and if it was under the weight that you were supposed to carry back, of course you were sent off to get another one or the remainder. I think it was something, I'm not sure whether 20 catties or 30 catties per person. I don't understand how the catty system worked, but I never did. But I used to have to go up there. We had to cut pine trees, mostly pine trees, and strip the branches off, bring them down the mountain by letting them just under their own inertia fall from the top of the mountain to the roadway, the dirt track at the bottom. And then once we got down and scrambled down and collected the particular log, but some of the logs were about 7 or 8 foot long, about 5 or 6, 7, 8 inches in diameter, some heavier than others. Obviously you tried to pick the lightest you could, but I mean, you had to bear in mind that it was going to be weighed when you got to the camp gates on one of these suspended weighing ropes, and if it wasn't the right weight, they were going to be sent back on the trek again, and you didn't appreciate that. So yes, I completed that day, and I always remember coming back, shoulders terrible, when with the bones poking up in the shoulders, and very little padding, only your own jacket, a small, they were issued with blue, the summer jackets, which were like a blue denim, very fine denim material, linen, like a linen material, a chairman mail jacket, we call them the mail style jacket, with buttoned up to your neck, the little collar all the way around, well, no lapels, peak cap, the Chinese squishy squashy peak cap with a peak, and a pair of trousers, and in blue. I always remember it was in like a pale blue, and that was our summer attire. That was when they first issued the POWs with actual clothing to replace the rotted uniforms, the remnants of your battle gear. My gear had fell apart a long time ago. I'd been reduced to a pair of combat trousers that had been cut down to a pair of shorts. The only thing left, rent ripped all over the place. My old inevitable pullover, which was still as hard as a board from where it had been sicked on with blood, and it was really, really hard and stank terribly. But I'd finally managed to get rid of that, and very few of us actually were prepared. Obviously, we weren't prepared to be captured, so we'd never geared ourselves up for that. We were in combat gear from springtime, when it was still cold, early spring, and of course we weren't equipped for the summer, we weren't equipped for long term marching or anything like that. And it was comical to see some of the things people had actually made. I remember that We all suffered from lack of all sorts of utensils, always. And therefore, of course, we were growing beards. We couldn't shave. Most of us had no razors because any stuff that you did have had been stripped off you at the combat area, i.e. the battleground, by the Chinese. They literally pilfered everything you had. And you made no resistance. You just gave it up. If they wanted it, they had it. There was no arguing about the situation. So obviously all our pack kit that we'd had, anybody who had had a knapsack was lost. They'd all been rifled and eventually disposed of. So you were down to a tin can with a wire hook on it that you probably made or found on route. If you happened to have a spoon, you were lucky, or a fork. You were quite well off. And very few water cans. I mean, it surprised me that the old issue Billy water bottle on its web, in its webbing case, very few people kept them. They seem to have disappeared. Now, whether they were taken off us along with our webbing equipment, which was disposed of at the battle site. I remember all my webbing equipment had to be taken off. They wouldn't have it. They wanted it off. And I had to release my webbing equipment, which was my... The thing that I had left was the pouch, the backpack, the small backpack, which had been hit with a bullet and had a bullet hole right the way through it anyhow. That, they took that away. My green belt, olive green belt, they took that away with a scabbard on, with a bayonet. Luckily, I don't know why, but everybody had said, get that bayonet and bury it. So while we were waiting to be stripped off by the Chinese captors, that's the front line troops there, I'd taken the bayonet out of its scabbard, you know, and pushed it into the dirt, down out of the way. They said, don't let them catch you with a bayonet attached to you. I don't know why they told me this. These were people here that were fellow comrades that were taken at the same time. But all of the equipment went. The webbing equipment, the cross straps, my front pouches, my backpack, that had all gone. And this was the case with most of the others as well. All of the equipment was stripped from you. And so basically carrying water or anything was a very difficult thing to do. You couldn't hardly carry water in a bean tin overnight marching. I mean, you soon lost most of it anyhow. You either drank it before you started, or you, if you carry it in your hand until you finally couldn't carry it no more, you drank it. That's how we survived. But in the camp itself, as I said, there was very little equipment given to us. And one of the things, as I try to point out, was we were all unshaven. There was no shaving equipment. And we found out that the Americans showed us this, that inside the American combat boot, in the instep, built into the heel and instep, was a flat metal or convoluted blade, a metal strip, and about 4 or 5 inches long, maybe 4 or 5 inches long. And if you broke open an old American combat boot and pulled this strip of steel out, you could sharpen it on stones till you eventually ended up with quite a sharp instrument. Very, very, very sharp instrument. And some people sat for hours and hours and hours sharpening these things up on stone until eventually they got them honed up on old bits of material or belts, or if anybody had a leather belt, it was stropped up until it became a barber's razor. And I had my first shave with one of these, and it was terrible. The pain of pulling out months and months and months of growth, like a bushy beard, up to 2 or 3 inches long, and the hacking through this a bit at a time to get it off your face. I always remember, I thought, oh, I wish I'd have kept the beard. But the beard was so lousy. Lice was, you know, prevalent. Your clothes were covered in lice. And you used to have lice squashing sessions where you sat down on the stoop of your particular hut and went along the seams of your clothes cracking lice. Oh, I mean, it became normal to crack lice. you weren't horrified about it in the end, but you accepted it as it's normal, and you needed to crack the lice because they were getting worse. You were literally overrun with them. I think the Chinese even realized we were so lousy because and all prevalent to typhoid that I got a feeling typhoid did break out in a number of cases, but never swept right the way through the POWs. But the Chinese come up with the idea of putting up 45-gallon drums on beside the river, lighting fires underneath it, boiling water up, and everybody had to come along and drop their clothes in and immerse their clothes in this 45-gallon drums of boiling water. And this was to stay in there for about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, and then they were brought out, and you washed them in the river, laid them out to dry, and hopefully you killed all the lice on there. But I mean, within a day or two, the lice were all back again. But I think the buildings were covered in them anyhow, the mud huts. And between having to have your beard shaved because it was so lousy, and I was suffering from dysentery, and I was gradually going downhill further and further. Every day that went by, every month that went by was an achievement, I felt. Yes, I sat out in the darkness on the end of the hut, away from my compatriots, and literally wept. And I was so low, so miserable. I just sat there like a bundle of bones and wept because of the privations and the fact that I was down to literally a walking skeleton, looked like a walking skeleton, according to people at the looked at me, and I was so low with dysentery, amoebic dysentery, it tears your stomach out. The pain comes at you every three or four minutes. You feel you must go to try to pass out what you had, but of course all you were passing out was blood and jelly and mucus. There was nothing to pass out. The amount of food you were getting was just being used up and coming out as water, rice mainly. But sorghum, as I said, we had sorghum, we had maize, we had millet seed. During the winter, as the winter closed in on the camp, and believe you me, it's a Siberian winter, I've never seen a winter like it. It must have been around about just on Christmas time for us, just before Christmas. And this was after the autumn had passed, after I'd been released from the hole, as I called it, the punishment hole. And the winter had come in. We'd done all the safaris out to cut the wood, the work details, and brought the wood. We had mountains of wood, and you drew your wood for your hut, and what you did at night time, or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you lit the fire in at the end of the hut, and the flames then and the heat went underneath the hut, and that would burn, say, for about an hour and a half. You kept feeding the fire with this wood and bits of straw, old sorghum stalks and the local stuff, and the resultant heat had heated up all the rocks underneath the house. So you actually laid on a hot floor, a hot mud floor with a rattan mat over the top of it.